Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm your host, Kate Young.
We've identified that there is a dominant narrative around hunger specifically, and that often it can perpetuate the very conditions of poverty and hunger.
Today on our show, as promised, we have a conversation about what it means to challenge the dominant narratives around hunger in the U.S., and why some emergency food providers are looking at root causes of food insecurity as they face growing numbers of people seeking food assistance. Harvest Public Media takes a look at labor shortages on farms in the face of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. And we have a quick salad recipe for you packed with nutrients and a tangy kick. That's all coming up, so don't touch that dial. First, some news with Alex Chambers. Hey, Alex, have you got some news for us today?
Hi, Kate. I've got a story today about deregulation in the meat industry.
All right, let's hear it.
Critics say the federal government's plan to lift production limits at hog slaughterhouses and packing plants would increase injuries in one of the country's most dangerous jobs. The plan would expand a pilot program that's been in the works for nearly 15 years, removing a cap on production speed and allowing companies to police themselves and to reduce the need for USDA inspection. The so-called HIMP, or HIMP, project allows facilities to determine their own production limits and set many of their own standards for testing foodborne diseases like E. coli. But a USDA audit in 2013 found that HIMP plants did not have adequate oversight and increased the likelihood of food safety risks. One of the pilot plants had the highest number of citations in the country from 2008 to 2011, with 50% more than any other plant. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, ranks animal slaughter and processing plants as the sixth worst workplace in the U.S. in terms of injuries. Carpal tunnel injuries are the most common at those plants due to repetitive motion at high speeds. The National Employment Law Project says that lifting limits on line speeds would jeopardize the safety of tens of thousands of workers who already face harsh working conditions. The proposal needs to be placed in the Federal Register and be open for comment for 60 days before it can go into effect. Poultry industry groups in September last year pushed for lawmakers to increase their speed limits on production lines. That proposal is still under review. Thanks to Chad Bouchard for that report, and you can find more at eartheats.org.
Thank you, Alex.
No problem, Kate.
With unemployment below 4% across the plains, and here in Indiana it's at 3.4%, many companies are looking for help. The labor shortage is stunting the growth of businesses as diverse as high-tech startups in Kansas City and huge dairy operations in western Kansas. President Donald Trump campaigned on a staunchly pro-business platform, but as Frank Morris reports for Harvest Public Media, his immigration policies don't seem to be easing the labor shortage.
Almost all the milk in the grocery store, the yogurt, and the cheese, come from big operations like this one out in western Kansas.
My name is Cipriano Gutierrez from McCarty Family Farms in Scott City. My title is parlor manager.
This milking parlor that Gutierrez oversees here is a cavernous room with a giant turntable in the middle, slowly rotating 60 cows at a time through the milking process. Fresh cows step on, milk cows hobble off, but the milk merry-go-round rarely stops, with workers furiously prepping, milking, and feeding every single day of the year.
24 hours a day, so sometimes a night shift is a tough job.
Think about it. You're working on the backside of great big smelly animals with minds of their own and bodily functions. Most native-born Americans turn their noses up at this kind of work. The same can be said of meat packing and produce harvesting, really any dirty job. Landscaping and construction companies, hotel and restaurant operators are struggling to fill positions that often go to immigrant workers. And dairy owners like Kyle Averhoff at Royal Dairy, east of Garden City, Kansas, scramble to keep their operations staffed.
Today it's definitely a tighter labor market than what it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. We're glad to have the people we have, and it's not always easy to go find the next people.
Averhoff says the whole dairy industry depends on immigrant labor, mostly from Latin America. And he says the last presidential election has raised doubts about the future of that workforce.
Anytime there's change, change creates uncertainty. And through the election, there was a lot of reasons for uncertainty. And so I think you just see people are looking for answers of what the future looks like. So
it's not so clear. President Trump has yet to follow through on his campaign promises to build a wall spanning the Mexican border or to launch a massive deportation force busing millions of immigrants out of the country. But high-profile immigration raids, like those on 7-Eleven stores earlier this month, have spiked. Numbers of people caught trying to sneak over the southern border plummeted after the election. Trump says he wants to cut legal immigration in half to about 500,000 people a year.
Mostly we've been combating a lot of fear.
Michael Feltman sits in his law office in Cimarron, Kansas. Feltman's been practicing immigration law for a decade. And he says Trump administration policies are spreading new anxiety through rural communities where immigrant labor is crucial.
You get mom and dad that are afraid because, oh man, we got some new person in there that's going to send everybody out of the country. Well, then that affects who? That's the kids, right? And then it's going to be affecting them at school, which affects the teachers, which affects...
Trump administration policies aren't the only things troubling immigrant workers. That includes well-paid, highly skilled professionals. When two Indian immigrants who worked at Garmin were shot at an Olathe restaurant last year, one of them killed, the suspect yelled, "Get out of my country," before opening fire. That forced a serious gut check for some local tech industry immigrants, like Sunipi Karapat.
After the presidential election, the hatred is normalized. If anybody can talk hatred and spread hatred, we are losing our civility.
Rapid worries the political atmosphere could dim the appeal of good American jobs, and that would be catastrophic to Kansas City's burgeoning tech industry.
The jobs exist, the people do not.
Ryan Weber is president of the KC Tech Council. He says a shortage of technically skilled workers is shackling the growth of local tech startups.
In fact, there are thousands of open tech jobs in Kansas City, and they pay exceptionally well. It's almost $90,000 a year average salary. I mean, they're well-paying jobs, but they do require skills.
Coding and engineering skills that Weber says most Americans lack, but abilities abundant in places like India. Meantime, Weber says the tech entrepreneurs he talks with have yet to see fallout from Trump immigration policy when it comes to filling jobs. He says they're still recruiting immigrants from graduating classes of regional universities. Problem is, those schools aren't seeing as many foreign engineering and coding students coming in these days. So President Trump's impact on the job market may just be starting to take hold. Harvest Public Media, I'm Frank Morris.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plain Safaris in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
And you can find more thoughtful reporting from across the heartland at harvestpublicmedia.org. And now we go to the kitchens of Farm Bloomington Restaurant with Chef Daniel Orr.
We are going to do a chickpea salad with feta and sorrel. The sorrel is a great herb to grow. It's a big, leafy, spinachy looking herb. It's a very lemony flavor. So we're going to drop those chickpeas in there. Now these are canned chickpeas that have been drained and rinsed, but you could cook your own chickpeas if you wanted to. Next we're going to add about 8 scallions. I'm not just going to cut the normal way where you just cut them into little rounds. I've cut them lengthwise, and then I'm going to cut them in about inch-long pieces. Then we're going to add a clove of minced garlic and the sorrel. Now, the sorrel I've cut into what we call in French chiffonade, which means kind of like a chiffon, kind of light and airy cut. I'm also going to add some other herbs. You could use any herbs you want: chervil, dill, mint, flatleaf parsley, cilantro, if you like. Now I'm going to kind of make a vinaigrette right in the bowl. And what I'm going to do is add the zest of about a half a lemon. Then, let's see, about 1 lemon's worth of lemon juice. Okay, we're going to add about 1/4 cup of extra virgin olive oil, salt and pepper to taste. Now we're going to be putting some feta in this, and feta is quite salty, so be careful with your salt. I'm going to toss that. And the sorrel is going to give it that nice lemony flavor, and it's been, you know, enhanced with the lemon juice and lemon zest, so it's going to be very kind of a zesty salad. Now that I've got that all mixed up, I'm going to fold in the feta. I didn't want to add the feta before because I want it to keep kind of chunky. I don't want it to be totally emulsified into the salad. Then at the very end, I've got a little bit of that sorrel reserved that I'm going to sprinkle around the top. Again, you could add, if you wanted to add some cherry tomatoes or some julienne red peppers to it for color, you could do that. But I kind of like it like it is. And there it is. That is our chickpea, feta, and sorrel salad.
And you can find that recipe and so many others on our website, eartheats.org. Support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Today on Earth Eats, we're going to take a deep dive into food insecurity in the United States and some of the stories that we tell ourselves as a culture about hunger. My guests today come to us from an organization called Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, also known as The Hub, in Bloomington, Indiana.
I am Amanda Nicky, the president and CEO of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
And I'm Stephanie Solomon, the director of education and outreach at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. We started as a food pantry with a focus on gardening and nutrition and healthy food. But when we moved in 2013 to our site at West Allen, we revisioned ourselves as a community food resource center. And what we mean by that is that we, yes, have a food pantry, and that is in fact our largest program, but it's housed within a resource center where not only can you come and access food assistance, but you can also learn about crockpot cooking or container gardening or borrow a crockpot or take a container home with you and borrow the tools that you need for your own garden, so that it's not just resources in terms of emergency food. It's resources in terms of what you need to build household food security. From the very beginning and by design, the Hub has been a food pantry that anyone can access in as dignified a way as possible, which is not always true when folks are looking to access services, social services around basic needs.
There's no means testing to use our services. People can come in. There's no really any forms to fill out or proof of identification or income level or need. We run on the honor system. People don't have to come in and jump through more hoops and prove their need in the ways that they might when they're accessing other resources. We trust that if people are coming in and getting food, then they need it. And it's not our place to judge whether they need it or how long they need it.
So I attended the Food Day event at the Hub this year and reported on it for Earth Eats, as you might remember. One of the components of the day involved addressing dominant narratives. And I was wondering, Stephanie, if you could start by talking about what you mean by a dominant narrative.
Dominant narratives are really the public narratives that surround us as we navigate the world. So there are narratives about larger issues of poverty, why some people have access to resources and why some people don't. And we've identified that there is a dominant narrative around hunger specifically, and that often it can perpetuate the very conditions of poverty and hunger. So Food Day gave us an opportunity to
to look at that public narrative and the ways that we as a community conceptualize hunger, why we think it exists, what the solutions are for it. And by tackling that narrative and really uncovering it, we can see where its truths and lies are and start to rebuild a narrative that's empowering and that truly addresses the roots of hunger and poverty.
So by narrative, dominant narratives, you're really talking about stories, the stories that the powerful stories coming from sort of the mainstream culture, the dominant culture, the culture with power. What are some of the stories that are surrounding food insecurity and hunger relief?
One of the narratives around hunger is that it's a temporary thing. You know, using services like ours or other emergency food services is just something that people are going to do for a short amount of time.
And what follows from that is really, when we talk about stories, the bootstrap story. There is embedded in that story the idea that we have equal opportunity to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and truly make the need for a food pantry like ours a temporary occurrence. But we know that that is a flawed story because we see the circumstances that lead to all different needs for food assistance that are often long term.
Yeah, I would add that, you know, the more attractive story that people want to hear is that it's a temporary need, that people come into the pantry, get some services for a couple of months, and then because of their ability to, you know, use our food pantry or our tool share or access to our education programming, then because of all of that coming together, then they are then able to kind of work their way out of that need, work their way out of poverty somehow. And I think that what's less attractive is that that's not the reality, really, for many of our patrons. Many of our patrons have been using emergency food services for years, and they will continue to use those services for years to come.
So it's not really emergency anymore. It's kind of a way of life.
It's one part of many resources in our community or beyond that people are using just to survive.
So why do you think that it's important to challenge these stories, and what kind of impact can that have?
I think what's most important in challenging these stories is that it helps us look at solutions from a different perspective. If we think that access to an emergency food pantry and the other kind of programming we have is that those things alone are going to solve hunger in our community, then we continue to put resources into those kinds of programs. We continue to support an emergency food pantry or education programs, you know, that kind of thing. But I think if we challenge those ideas and say we have to do more than just this programming, it just changes the way that we approach the problem. And I think that's where our advocacy work comes in that we recognize that just these kind of program things that we're doing alone are not going to solve these problems. We have to find ways for people to engage in their larger community, for people to get involved in legislation, for people to understand what's happening, the decisions that are being made about their lives and how they're going to impact them.
And we cannot advocate around food security with the single narrative and the single story that we have about people and poverty and hunger as it stands. And so part of our advocacy work is starting to lift up the real stories and the lived experiences of people who are needing food assistance, whether it's on a monthly or a longer term basis. So to ground why dominant narrative is an important topic, we have to look at the problematic stories surrounding hunger and how we can get the true stories out into the world.
So I wonder if you could give me an example of something that you might take on in your advocacy work or some way of changing or challenging that dominant narrative and replacing it with something else.
So we are launching, in partnership with Hoosier Action, the Food and Farms Coalition, which is a campaign to focus on the 2018 reauthorization of the Farm Bill. And we have a group of small farmers, SNAP recipients, and pretty much those of us that eat food, which is all of us, who are going to be coming together to talk about how important the Farm Bill is. And with our Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly on the Agriculture Committee, we have a great opportunity to lift up some real stories of what people are experiencing. There are not very many stories about the experiences of Hoosiers who are attempting to farm and Hoosiers who have food stamps but not enough food stamps, or Hoosiers who qualify for food stamps but struggle to jump through all the hoops that they need to jump through to get access to them. And so this is a great example of where not only is it an advocacy campaign with a focus on improving the local and regional food system, but also on bringing out some of those stories that tend to be missing from the conversation.
Well, one of the things I heard one of you mention was something about addressing root causes to hunger. So what are some of those root causes that lead people to need to come to a place like Mother Hubbard's Cupboard to access food?
One that's really obvious that I guess we don't talk about very often is money. People don't not have food because there isn't food to be had. It's because they don't have money to buy it. It's really simplistic, but the solutions to that are really complex. And I think that that's why we don't talk about it. That's why we don't want to think about that when we think about food access or the number of people in our community who are food insecure, or that still 1 in 5 children in our community don't have access to adequate food on a daily basis. We don't want to think about the fact that it's just a lack of income that's making that happen, a lack of adequate income, because solving that problem is so much more complex than hosting a food drive.
If you're just joining us here on Earth Eats, my guests are Amanda Nicky and Stephanie Solomon with the Community Food Resource Center in Bloomington, Indiana. We've been talking about the dominant narrative surrounding hunger in America and what it means to focus on root causes of food insecurity.
So if we see hunger as an issue of inadequate food, then the best way to address it is obviously through food pantries and food banking and SNAP benefits. But if we look at root causes and we take hunger out of a vacuum and look at it through the lens of poverty and money, then our solutions change. And that's what we're trying to do by redefining the narrative.
And I would add that there's always the risk here of sounding like what we're saying is we shouldn't have food pantries, or we shouldn't have food banks, or emergency food programs shouldn't exist. And I want to say that that's not what we're saying. What we are saying is that it's not the sole responsibility of those organizations to solve the problem of hunger. It's impossible for those organizations to solve the problem of hunger. We don't have the power that the greater community has to draw attention to these issues, to provide solutions for these issues. But we're often tasked collectively as emergency food providers to solve this problem, to show how we're improving the lives of our patrons, to show how we're providing opportunities for growth. And I think we have to be honest and say that there's only so much we can do there.
The narrative that has been successful is that people need to eat now. And we should be proud of the work that our food banks and soup kitchens and food pantries do to address the fact that people need to eat now.
And I think it can be challenging to think on an individual level, kind of the decisions that we make or the ways that we live that perpetuate this problem for people in our community. And so when we I don't know, it can be really uncomfortable to think more deeply about the decisions that you make on a daily basis that allow for economic inequities.
Like what?
Like development, wages in our community. I don't know. There's a lot of things that we choose to do as a community that it seems like we're not thinking about what's best for everyone. you know, a school putting on a food drive around the holidays is not in itself a bad thing. It's a very kind and thoughtful thing. But on a greater scale, it's not enough. And how often are we doing these small, seemingly caring and well-intentioned things that keep us from addressing the greater problems? And that's a really tricky place to be, because it's not that those actions in themselves are hurtful or unkind. They're the opposite. They're taking care of people in a moment when they need it. But in some ways, it's distracting us from the larger problems, and it's keeping us, it's keeping our hands busy with getting food out the door and the day-to-day challenge of just feeding people. And so we don't have, as an organization or as a community, we don't have the time and the resources to focus on those bigger problems.
So addressing some of those root causes, like living wages or affordable housing, or the kind of things that might lift people out of poverty so that they don't need to go to a food pantry or don't need to apply for food stamps because they have a sustainable life.
Right. I mean, we all want to be able to care for our families to the best of our ability and to not have to rely on services or government support. But we have to be honest and say that not everyone has that same opportunity. And that's a good place to start.
I've been speaking with Amanda Nicky and Stephanie Solomon from Mother Hubbard's Cupboard about the stories surrounding food insecurity and ways to begin tackling the root causes of hunger in the U.S. And I knew this would happen. We have more than we can cram into one episode. We'll continue our conversation next week on Earth Eats, and we'll be looking at how unicorn stories, you know, the ones of individuals rising up from difficult circumstances to lead successful lives, how those often inspirational stories can end up clouding our understanding and even masking the structural inequities that are built into our society. I hope you can join us next week for the rest of our conversation. Or better yet, subscribe to our podcast so you won't miss an episode. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, consider giving a rating or a review. It means a lot to us, and thank you. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Thank you to everyone who makes Earth Eats happen each week, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Amanda Nicky and Stephanie Solomon. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young. Thanks for tuning in this week. We'll see you next time on Earth Eats.